You all probably know, for the past 15 years, Mario Cuomo has been a leading voice and advocate for progressive government. But you may not know much about his life story. He was born in New York City during the Depression to two Italian immigrants. In the beginning of the first grade, he only spoke broken English. But by the time he graduated from St. John's Law School, he was at the top of his class. He then clerked at the highest court in New York State and spent about 15 years at a Queens law firm. While he was active there, he was active in both civic and community affairs. He first came to public prominence in the mid-1970s when he helped mediate some disputes between the mayor of New York City, John Lindsay, and various homeowners groups in Forest Hills and Corona, Queens. In 1975, he became Secretary of State of New York. In 1978, he was elected Lieutenant Governor. And in 1982, he was elected as the 52nd Governor of New York State, a position he held until 1995. For the past 4 years, Governor Cuomo has been a partner in the New York City law firm of Wilkie Farr & Gallagher. There, he's engaged in an eclectic corporate practice, but all the while maintained his interest in and involvement in politics and public affairs generally. So I hope you will join me in welcoming Mario Cuomo.
Thank you. I don't want you to think that I didn't show you the respect of preparing remarks. I did, and they're all here, and I can read them if you like. But I just taking one look at you and being reminded by David Colon of why I wanted to be here in the first place, which was to spend some time with students, I'm not going to give the speech. What I'd like to do is prod you a little bit and then get right to the questions and answers so that we can deal with the things that you think are cogent instead of my having to guess at that in a long and rambling dissertation. I did that the last time I was here. I was at the Kennedy School and spoke for so long that Alan Simpson said at the end of it he was going to put in his papers for retirement. He had no intention of doing that at the beginning of the speech. And that's because if I get into the issues, which I do almost inevitably, I get so taken by them and so absorbed by them that it's very hard for me to abbreviate the presentation, because there's so much about this country that needs addressing. And there's a kind of irony there for most people, because most people would tell you that this is perhaps the most successful moment we've had in our modern history, maybe our entire history. And there is a good deal of superficial evidence that that's the case. There's no question that the stock market is uniquely successful. Stock market has been successful for what, 8-9 years in a row in an economy? Well, the stock market and the economy for 8 or 9 years in a row. The stock market even stronger than the economy. Stock market is ascending almost without rationale. It used to be that you had to measure the earnings and project exactly how this company would do against the competition, but now all you have to do is to say it's part of the internet. Of course they're going to do well. It's Amazon. And so you don't need earnings. And there you are. And what happens when you have that kind of success in the stock market? A lot of people who never made money before make it. A lot of people who have always made money make more than they can count, like our law firm, which has had 4 years in a row record earnings. 47 cents on a dollar we make. 47 cents on a fee dollar, and we have set records for 4 years in a row for earnings. 47 cents on a dollar, and we've set a record for 4 years in a row. Why? Because everybody's doing mergers and acquisitions and heavy corporate work, and we've profited from it. And so we have more billionaires, more millionaires, more people over $100,000 than ever before in the history of the United States of America. That's wonderful. Absolutely. My mother loves it, wherever she is, and I'm sure it's in something like a heaven. Because she left us here when she was about 95 a few years ago. But I remember my mother and what she would have said about this kind of success. I remember it because as a governor, I was very unhappy that she had never expressed to me vast satisfaction with the success of her youngest child. She never once said, gee, you're doing great, Mario. That's because I was the youngest of three. And my oldest brother was never a governor or a president, nor was my sister. And so since the people older than I in the House hadn't achieved any thing like governorship. She couldn't give me credit for the governorship because it wouldn't show respect to the other children. And the net result was I was governor for 3 terms and she never said a thing. And so I, you know, especially near the end, I was constantly prodding her and hanging around with her and hoping for little signs of acceptance and satisfaction, not to say approval. And one day we were together and I was talking to her about the governorship and how hard it was and how well I was doing. And she looked down and there was a Fortune magazine. And the Fortune magazine had a face on the cover and she said, "Kia, who is that?" And I think she spoke only Italian, at least to the family. Spoke broken English to everybody else. Imagine that. Here's a couple who came from Italy, never educated a day there, never educated a day here. Just a generation before me. Wasn't long time ago. Best thing he could do was a ditch digger in the Depression. That was the best job there was for him. And somehow, this miracle of a place allowed him to develop a family. Anyway, here's Mama, about 90 years old, saying, "Kia." And I said, "Well, let me say, oh, that's Lee Iacocca." She said, "Ah, I guess he looked Italian," and she noticed that. And she said, "Kia, what does he do?" And I said, "Well, let me see what the story is about." And I turned to the story in Fortune magazine. I said, "Ma," in Italian, I said, "he makes $20 million, I guess it was, a year, but he says it's not enough." And she says, "Vin, 20? I said, "Yes." She says, "What does he do?" I said, "He is the head of Chrysler." And I explained in my broken Italian and English, you know, "he fai automobili, he makes cars." $20 million. She looked at me, she says, "What's the matter? You don't know how to make a car?" And I had been governor for 3 years. So there, everybody rejoices at this kind of success, and we should. And we should rejoice that the unemployment rate is so low. That's a terrific thing, that people at the lowest levels are getting jobs. And we should rejoice at the interest rate being so low. And we should rejoice that we are the largest military power the world has ever seen, and there's nothing to match us. And that we have the greatest economy the world has ever seen, nothing to match us. And that we've been the most wonderful engine of opportunity for over 10 generations. That's how I got to be governor. That's how Mama and Papa made it. 10 generations of people like Mama and Papa, coming from places where they couldn't possibly have succeeded in anything that approximated the success they had here. Only in America, literally. Of course. And that's more and more evident. They're still coming, still dying to get here. And they'll be successes the way I was and much, much more. And there were millions of people like me and Iacocca and Paluski and now, and it goes on and on and on. There's no doubt about all of that. And I'm more aware of it than anybody, and I rejoice, and I would kiss the hands of the public school teachers who taught me how to speak English. And I revere this country as much as I am allowed to. But I know one other thing, and this frustrates me, that in my old neighborhood of South Jamaica, Queens, the public school I went to is worse than when I went to it. And that in this society, with 5% of our people now living in the shining city on a hill, which is the all-time record, there are more poor people than there were in 1989. And that while billions of dollars are being made in healthcare by a lot of intelligent investors, healthcare is getting worse and worse. Not only are the HMOs shriveling the kind of service we get, they've made movies about that, Jack Nicholson, Good as It Gets, and because they made a movie, that will probably be remedied, because now they're all talking about an HMO Bill of Rights, and we will improve HMOs and the kind of health insurance plans you get. But while we're busy doing that, and I cheer that progress, 43 million people who are not poor enough for Medicaid, not old enough for Medicare, not lucky enough to have a boss who gives them a policy, not rich enough to buy their own, are working, most of them, and can't afford health insurance. You know what that means? That means a 37-year-old woman, actual case, with a 17-year-old daughter, a 12-year-old son, working at under the average wage for a family, average wage for a family in this country, under $38,000, working for about $30,000 in New York, a tough place to be making $30,000, can't afford health insurance, working hard, all alone, nobody to help her at home, her 2 kids, gets breast cancer. No health insurance policy. Well, does she get health care? Absolutely, because no one gets turned away in New York or anywhere else in the United States, to the best of my knowledge. You're poor, you go to the clinic, you go to the emergency room, someone takes care of you. In New York, as a matter of law, they must take care of you. Find an old woman on the street on the weekend, which happens every Saturday night, every Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Sunday night as well. Bring her to Bellevue. No identity, no way of knowing whether she can, whether she has any identity. Certainly no Medicaid, no Medicare available, no health insurance available. If you have to put her on the machine, you put her on the machine. And there are people there on the machine who nobody knows and nobody claims, who are being kept alive, if you can call it that, because we have that kind of commitment to taking care of health. But it won't be anything like the health care my daughters would get. She'll get a reasonable health care, and it will bankrupt her. Why? Because they'll bill her for it. And when she says, well, I have no health insurance and I only have $6,000 in assets, they'll take that, you go to bankruptcy. That's why you've set a new bankruptcy record every year for 6.5 years. I didn't know that. I didn't know there were 43 million people like that. 43 million. Mario, they never even mention it. No, of course they don't mention it. It's not a political issue. There is no constituency there. There is no vote there. And Jack Nicholson didn't make a movie about it. I know this is the greatest country in world history. I also know it could be much, much better than it is. I also know that we have people in this country, most workers, most of the 160 million workers, aren't going anywhere. The people who are doing well are people like me and my clients, people like you and your family, and when you get out, you'll be in the top 0.001%. God bless you. That is as it should be. And if Mama were here, she'd say, that's right. And don't settle for $20 million if you can get more. And that's as it should be. But the people in the top 5% who are working are high-skilled people. The irony there is of the 160 million workers we have, guess how many, what percentage you think, are high-skilled? High-skilled means 4 years after high school. What's your guess? In this, the most powerful country in the world, in this, the most, the wealthiest, and the most facility-ridden, and the most resource-rich. We can put people on the moon. You have Porsches parked next to BMWs. We have affluent you couldn't dream of anywhere else. Guess how many of our workers are high-skilled? 1 out of 5, so few that we have to import 115,000 computer engineers a year for $90,000 to $110,000 jobs, because 80% of our workers are low and moderate skilled, and they, in the parlance of old Queens, ain't going nowhere. They haven't gone anywhere for maybe 10, 12 years. They're just barely staying in one place if they're working. They're all working. The unemployment rate is low. But they're not going anywhere. As a matter of fact, they are. They are. I'm sorry. I apologize. They're going backwards. Because the average increase in their wages is what? 2%, 3%. God forbid. If you got any more than that, Alan Greenspan would raise the interest rate. Because if you gave them a big wage increase and he didn't see a productivity increase to make up for it, he would say that's inflationary, he'd be right, and then he'd give you an interest rate increase and the economy would go down the tubes. So we're not going to give any wage increases, but the cost of health insurance, the cost of higher education, the cost of housing, the cost of transportation, all the things these workers, these middle class people, like most people in America, 160 million of them, the 80% are low and moderate skilled, the cost of those things are growing much faster than their wages, so they're falling backward. So now you have the 40 million people, worse than in 1989, who are poor, going nowhere. We gave up on them when we passed the welfare reform bill. We said, they'll work or starve, that'll take care of them, incentive will do the rest. We took care of them, you know, we have incentives. If you're very rich, the incentive is a capital gains tax cut. If you're very poor, your children starve if you don't work. You know, it's called carrots for the rich, and sticks for the poor. I didn't make it up. That's the truth of it. I know this. Why? Because I was governor for 12 years, and secretary of state, and lieutenant governor, and a lawyer before that representing people who couldn't afford a lawyer. People who were facing the electric chair only because they were broke, and who didn't get the electric chair because I finally decided to represent them. People who were going to lose their houses to the mayor of the city of New York only because they couldn't speak English. And didn't finally because someone who could speak English represented them for 6 years. And I know and I learned through all of that time that this is the greatest country in world history, but it's not nearly as good as we could be. Of course we could make more of our 80% workers high skilled. Of course more of them could go to college. Of course education could be better in this country. Of course we can do something about the 43 million people without health care. Of course we can. In the past, the reasons given were, well, globalization, and you can't do it because it costs money to do education, and we have a big deficit, and for a long time we did. Or you're going to have to raise the taxes, and for a long time that was a problem. But now you have $4 trillion between now and 10 years from now. $4 trillion, and how are they talking about spending it? Well, the dominant party is saying, let's spend $800 billion on tax cuts. For whom? For the poor people? No. For those low and moderate skilled workers? No. For whom? For my clients. And for people like them. Not all of it, but a lot of it. You know, a couple of years ago, when Alan Greenspan said, the problem with this economy is exuberance. Remember that? Now, did you ever read Fountainhead? You ought to read Fountainhead. If you want to figure out what Alan Greenspan's all about, read Fountainhead. No, I'm serious. He's an Ayn Rand roundie. And what he was really saying is, problem is people are buying and selling too much. So how did we respond to that prescription? And everybody knows we do everything Alan Greenspan says. We give a capital gains tax cut. And what is the theory of the capital gains tax cut? It's good for business. Why? It encourages buying and selling. And what does it do to exuberance? Forget about exuberance. It's not relevant here because we want to give the tax cut. Now that's what's happening again. I can go on and on with this, but I'm not, because I told you I'm not going to make a speech. But I'm trying to explain to you why I came. I came because I do this. I do it everywhere. I read everything I can read, because now I'm not governor anymore. And while I'm very busy as a lawyer, I have time to read and I have time to speak. And I debated Jack Kemp twice, and I'm going off to debate about a month ago. To debate Dan Quayle, I guess it's next week or the week after, and I've debated Bill Bennett, and I've debated Ralph Reed, and I've debated Peter Domenici on healthcare, always in their place, always with Republican audiences, and always the same thing happens, that, you know, they resent my appearance, they resent my debate, and they resent me even more when I leave, because they're less comfortable when I leave than when I came in. Why? Because I'm telling them the whole truth. There's no magic to it. There's no brilliance to it. There's no eloquence required, no subtlety. All you have to do is have familiarity with the truths here. Question, are we as good as we could be? No. Could we get more people into the circle of opportunity? Yes. Will we do it? No. Why not? Because the politicians have lowered our expectations, the Democrats and the Republicans alike. They've done it very methodically, the Democrats, because we got wiped out a few years ago, and we were weak before that. People felt that we were too soft on crime, and for some Democrats, they were right. Not for me, frankly. I built 64,000 cells. I'm disgusted by the fact that I had to, but I did. But anyway, the impression was Democrats are soft on crime, welfare doesn't work, all of these impressions, and so that we have to correct that. And how did you correct that? You went too far. You threw the baby out with the bathwater, et cetera, et cetera. And so the Democrats have run away and started saying things like the era of big government is over. That was a Democrat who said that. The era of big government is over? Did he mean it? No, of course not. Why did he say it? Well, because it was politically adroit. What did it mean? Well, literally what it would mean is the era of defense is over. The era of Social Security is over. The era of Medicare is over. The era of Resolution Trust Corporation is over. Resolution Trust Corporation, now up to $500 billion, largest bureaucracy since the Depression. Social Security, we all know what that is. Nobody's going to mess with Social Security. Their hand would palsy on the way to the lever before they took it down, before they would do anything on Social Security. But these three, four pieces are 61% of the whole budget. So if you said the era of big government is over, did you mean that? Did you mean the space program? No. Did you mean Medicaid? No. Did you mean public schools? No. What did you mean? The poor people. It was their way of saying, don't worry about all those, the funny poor people you see who are using their food stamps to buy steak while you're working yourself to death, Mr. Middle Class. And meanwhile, the rich people and the sophisticated people all sat back and said, oh boy, isn't this cute? It's working great. because we're using them as a stereotype, and the net result is that all of government budgets, all those discretionary budgets get pushed down. And so the Democrats have given up on it. Now Clinton came back and got Dick Morris's strategy, which is triangulation. You know what triangulation is? You tiptoe through the political bog, learned hand, right? Tiptoeing through the morass, you go from stone to stone across the morass. Well, they go from stone to stone across the political morass. Go to the left if that's where the stone is. Go to the right. Take the safe stones. No big issues, nothing controversial. Well, what should we talk about? 96, the election. What should we talk about? The middle of the election campaign. What did the Democrats talk about? And then the Republicans. The middle of the campaign, with 40 million people at that time without health insurance, with all these poor people, with all these problems, gay marriages. Where did that issue come from? Gay marriages. Did somebody take a picture in New York City of the people at the license bureau, you know, all these guys lining up, or all these gals saying, I want to marry somebody just like me? I mean, where did the issue come from? What made it relevant? Was there a lawsuit about to be decided which was going to change the direction of a... No. There was a poll that said 72% of Americans are against gay marriage. And so somebody made it an issue. Why? Because it's terrific. I've got 72% to start. And so the president came out against, everybody came out against gay marriage. Terrific. And what about the poor people? That's triangulation. That's how we won in 96. Let Dole lose and don't make any mistakes. Don't say anything big. Now, I wrote something about this in the middle of the, just before the convention in 96. I wasn't going to speak at the convention. I wrote a little piece that said, look, unless we say something big about these real problems as Democrats, the president's going to win because Dole is going to lose. But then he won't have a mandate. We won't have 51% of the House, and we won't be able to do anything in the next administration. What happened? We didn't win 51% of the vote. We didn't get the House. We didn't get a mandate. But mirabile dictu, the economy, in a flash, became fantastic. And the stock market went crazy. But think about it. In 96, nobody predicted this economy in the election campaign. President, nobody predicted it. Nobody. How did it happen? Nobody knows for sure. I think the tax increase of 93 by President Clinton helped get down the deficit. Bush's eating his promise and passing a tax cut that helped bring down the deficit, that helped a little bit. But it's much more than that. It's probably high technology, which had been out there for 15 years, improving productivity, nobody being able to count it, and all of a sudden it just started showing itself. I don't know, and I haven't heard any more intelligent explanation for that. I'll buy that one. Anyway, that's where we are, and I know it. So what do we need? We need people to study these issues. We need people to get interested in them, especially people like me who have had the opportunity to, and I feel it more than maybe you do at this stage in your life because I'm at a different stage. You know, I spent a whole adulthood not giving a damn about politics. I didn't like the politicians. They never came to my neighborhood in South Jamaica. They were never there for Mama and Papa. They never helped us one bit as far as I could tell. Roosevelt, yes, in the Depression. And Mama and Papa would tell us stories about that, how the little place where they lived was kept alive by work projects and then the relief program, which was the predecessor to welfare, which was really, if you worked in the WPA, we'll give you some tickets that you can go and feed your family with. And that was, thank God for that. And then there was unemployment insurance and workers' compensation were invented then, and then Social Security. But in my old neighborhood, forget about it. We never saw a politician. I despised them. And as a young lawyer, I did because I saw what they were trying to do to the Corona homeowners. I saw what they did to the neighborhood of Forest Hills. I saw what they did to these two people who had gotten railroaded on the way to the electric chair because they made lousy defenses. I saw what politicians were doing, and I said, this isn't right. The hell with them. I'm going to make money. I'm going to take care of my family and make fun of the politicians. And I did for 20 years. And made a mistake because, you know, I looked up at the end of 20 years when Watergate happened and said, look at this. I mean, look at this. What am I accomplishing cursing these guys? Let me see if I, you know, I felt like a hypocrite. I felt I'd better get involved. So I've learned a lot. I feel guilty about my own success because I haven't done enough, you know, to see that other people share the good opportunities I had. A really good public school, scholarships of all kinds. I never paid a penny to go to school. And kids now are getting kept from, kids much brighter, much more deserving than I, getting kept from college because we can't make college accessible to them. I know that my family did very, very well. We had health insurance policies, we had everything we need, and we had an almost assured ascendancy in the years of the American dream from 45 to 75. All you had to be was a middle-class guy, raised five children, built a Cape Cod house in Queens, had a Bel Air Chevrolet. Now, you didn't live lavishly. Didn't have a Wall Street, I graduated first in my class, but couldn't get into a Wall Street firm. That's a whole other story. Somebody once suggested to me, maybe Mario, you should change your name. And I've often thought about that. I wonder what I would have looked like as a Mark Conrad. But anyway, so I feel this with a special passion. But any of you, and there are a lot in this room, I'm sure, certainly there are a lot in Harvard who have studied the issues, you have to feel some of the resentment, perhaps, the unease, at the very least, that I feel with an America capable of so much more power and strength and beauty than we've manifest. How is that going to happen? It's not going to happen until we get more leadership from the people themselves, especially in a time like this that has politicians following the polls with almost a Pavlovian sureness. They do everything the polls say. That means we have to educate one another. We have to educate the people. We have to learn these issues. We have to learn the truths. I'm not talking about ideology. I'm not talking about being a Democrat. You may disagree with everything I say. That's irrelevant. I like to think in maybe the highest form of flattery of myself, I like to think that if people all had a chance to study the issue, they'd all come to the conclusions I did. But I understand that's not going to happen, that a lot of you come to different conclusions and may be there already. But the whole system would be better if we had more people in it studying the issues, speaking about the issues, having their voices heard. Only 40% of the registered voters even vote. 40%. What a disgrace. What a disgrace. So where would you go for it? People to get involved. Could you do better with Harvard? What did Rabbi Hillel say? If not you, then who? If not now, then when? I mean, who's better than Harvard? So I come to Harvard, and I went to NYU last week, and I went to Stanford, and I go to places where there are people like you. And what is there about you? You're talented. God bless you. You were made that way. Don't ever be embarrassed to say it about yourself, or prideful because you didn't do it. You were born talented. What you did do was work hard. That you deserve credit for. And so now you're special commodities. You're among the best we have to offer. The best talent, the best minds. And now you're lawyers in a great law school, maybe a uniquely great law school. And they're going to help improve your ability to analyze things. Ah, just what we need. Somebody who can look at these complicated truths and see where solution lies. And you're brilliant articulators. And your people who have learned to fight intellectually. That's what we need. We need more of that. We should have everybody in Harvard out there full-time doing what? At the very least, studying the issues, speaking about them, writing to the newspapers, doing your internet chats. Could you get more than that? Oh, yeah. Maybe you could support a candidate. That would be terrific, too. How about more than that? Well, beyond supporting a candidate, when you go to law to a law firm, in my law firm, thanks to a guy by the name of David Cologne, who was up here introducing me and the reason I came back, David Cologne was a summer associate. He came to me midway in his term, and he said, you know, Governor, I think there are a lot of guys here like me. I'm from Harvard, but I think there are a lot of guys and gals here who are interested in a bigger picture than just the law. We'll do the law. We know. We love the law. We want to maybe even make a life as lawyers, but there's more to life than a well-conducted litigation, and we understand that. Or a brilliantly developed merger and acquisition. We understand that. And we want to be sure that, you know, the people, our colleagues here with whom we're going to spend so much time, that some of them at least share our interest in bigger issues. I said, well, you know, there is the pro bono, but that's basically legal. I said, look, I think this is a great idea, and if you can get the associates to develop it, I will personally help support a bigger interest group. David called it the public interest group, until I pointed out that the acronym was PIG. So we made it bigger interest group. And just to be sure we weren't foisting anything on this population, just to be sure that Cologne wasn't unique, you know, I said to, he did a little memo, and I whacked it up a little bit, and it got spread among the associates, and I told him, David, the initiative will not come from me. It has to come from you. Because for this thing to work, You have to show the partners here that there's a lot of interest in this group in doing this kind of thing. Doing what? Meeting once a month, regularly. Meeting with people who understand, discussing, debating, fighting. What? Kosovo, our first meeting in May. Social Security and Medicare for people our age, will it be there? Stagnation in wages, is there any answer? What the hell is globalization? What is sovereignty? We'll get to that when we get to Kosovo. What is the law? You went from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution. In this rapidly globalizing world, you think we'll go from the Constitution of the United States of America and the parliamentary governments of the European nations to a new world constitution? And would that be good or bad? And how long would you think that that would take? And what kind of world would it give us? Now, that's a nice question. It's legal. Incidentally, we know that all the important political issues are sooner or later legal issues. We know that, and it didn't take the Frenchman to teach us that, although he said it very prominently in his genius work. But that's the truth, too. Now, all of those issues are going to be treated. 45 associates have signed founding associates document, and 15 partners, I among them, are in the advisory partners. And this thing is going to get off to a big, big start in May, and it's going to go on and on and on and build, and it's all over the law firm now. They love it. They love it, all of them. The partners who are making a friend, there are one or two people who couldn't care less, maybe more. But there are always going to be people like that. And then maybe someday, after you pay off your loans, after you've made a living, after you've maybe developed a family, after you've knocked the law on his can, you know, handle all the competition in Los Angeles or New York or Boston or wherever you go, after you've taken care of yourself and you've got money in the bank and you've gone around the world a couple of times and, you know, you've gotten the Porsche finally, and maybe you look around and say, hey, this really isn't enough. You know, and maybe you'll decide, like I did at a late stage in my life, and maybe I ought to get in there and see if I can't do something. Boy, would I love that. I went in for 20 years. I haven't regretted a moment of it. Best years I ever had. They knocked me down. They made a fool of me. I lost 3 elections in a row. They called me academic, foolish, no chance to succeed. I was 38 points behind. If you're Italian, they suggest all sorts of dire associations in your background just from the arrangement of vowels in your name. If you're a woman, they say once every month she won't be able to function. If you're Jewish, they say, why is he doing this? We know he's rich. I mean, you have all those stupid stereotypes, and you see them in a way that you never saw them before, and you feel them in a way. All of that happens to you. There are plenty of negatives, but at the end of the day, you say to yourself, I tried, damn it, I tried. I was in there giving it my best shot, you know, and I made the effort. And maybe at least when I drop dead, if there is some kind of currently inscrutable but eventually inevitable judgment, then maybe they'll remember that all the good things I got, I didn't take for granted. And I tried to do something about paying back. Maybe some of you will feel like that. If one of you does, it makes the trip worthwhile. And if none of you does, then I'll probably force another invitation and come back. Thanks for listening to me. Okay.
Thank you, Governor. If any of you, I know, have certainly questions, there's mics on either side, and if you could, I guess we'll start on the right and fire away and let him see what he says.
Yes, sir.
Hi, Governor Cuomo. I was present for your talk at the Kennedy School 2 months ago, in February. It was actually George Washington's birthday, and at that time I thought to ask you a question of presidents. Now that we're in April, and this marks the week that Jackie Robinson broke into the major leagues, my question today to you is about baseball and the American dream, two other subjects along with presidencies that you've thought a lot about. My question is this. At the talk you gave at the Kennedy School, you talked a lot about, at the talk you gave at the Kennedy School, you repeated your refrain, your often repeated refrain from Paul Simon refrain, where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio, a nation turns its lonely eyes to you. Since then, we've lost Joe DiMaggio. But my question that
not
I...
Not really. But...
No, I mean, actually, and but my question for you is has to do with baseball players and the American Dream. After Joe DiMaggio, we had Jack Roosevelt Robinson. And when he played, the only refrain that we would get for him was, did you see Jackie, you probably remember this song, did you see Jackie Robinson hit that ball? Oh, well, yeah, he hit it far. And after that, we had the Hammer, who broke the Babe's record, probably the most cherished record in baseball until a white man broke another storied home run record. And we had Roberto Clemente, who you may have even played with in the minor leagues for in the Pirate system, of whom little was said until his life ended trying to repair the strife of another nation. All of those are, the one thing that separates Joe DiMaggio from all those other ball players is the question of race and how race plays into the American dream and the American dilemma. And I want to see if you would address the matter of race in American politics and the question of heroes and how come such heroic status is not granted to similar men of character or such mythological.
I don't believe that's true. I'm listening and I heard what you said and I would ask you for more time and I'd like to study it and write out an answer, but we're not going to be able to do that. So let me answer it just instinctively. I don't believe that's true. I don't believe that if you insist on comparability, if you make the equation appropriately, that we have denied Italians hero status because they were Italians or blacks. We certainly didn't do it for Michael Jordan. We certainly didn't do it for Bill Russell. We certainly didn't do it for Joe Louis. Now, I can tell you, Joe Louis Barrow, he was a hero for me. They asked me, I did a lot of television about Joe DiMaggio because for a number of reasons, I'd known him and I'd been in the film, the HBO film, etc. And they said, could you think of anybody in your time comparable? I said, Joe Louis Barrow. I mean, Joe was black. They called him the Brown Bomber. That was a Ray Robinson. You want a hero. Now, I don't know how much you know about boxing. There was a gym across the street from our store, the Beaver Gym. I boxed six times and six bouts until the sixth one. If you ever get knocked out, it really is quite a feeling. But Ray Robinson was a great hero. So no, I don't think that's true. There is rampant racism in the United States of America. There's no question about that. There is also tremendous anti-Semitism, much more than we admit to. And there's no doubt about that. And I'm an expert on that. I've worked on that since the Second Vatican Council in the 60s, when the Catholic Church tried to apologize to the Jewish people. It is a fact that in my years as lieutenant governor, the year before I ran for governor, the AFL-CIO did a poll to find out if I had any chance in New York State of winning a governorship. And I don't remember the exact numbers, and I'm still looking for the poll, but I remember the point. In the question, do you know him well enough to make a judgment? The answer was something like 18% said yes. Then when you got to the open-ended question, would you vote for this man for governor? Something like 24% of the people said no. A large percentage of them giving the reason because of organized crime. They didn't know me. And they were giving the reason because of organized. Why? Because of my name, Mario Cuomo, and my face. I mean, I don't look like Guy Madison or Tyrone Power or Gregory Peck. I look like Mario Cuomo. And I talk that way. And I remind people that that's where I'm from. So there is, I understand all of that, and it's a problem. It's part of our immaturity. We're only 200 years old. I was the first Italian-American ever elected governor of the state of New York. I had to appoint the first woman after 200 years to the Court of Appeals. I had to appoint the first black after 200 years to the Court of Appeals. I had to appoint the first Hispanic after 200 years to our state Court of Appeals. New York, the bastion of liberalism, where all the immigrants came. So we have a lot of work to do. But no, I don't think you make the case that, see, if Hank Aaron had been in New York, he would have been Joe DiMaggio. There's no question about that. New York was a great booster of Ray Robinson, great booster of Michael Jordan, great booster of all the great black athletes. No, I don't think that's a proper case. Now, the irony is Jackie Robinson. The discrimination was selecting Jackie Robinson over some other great black players in professional baseball who everybody agreed were better than Jackie. You know, Josh Gibson was one of them. You know, Josh Gibson was a fantastic, I saw him as a kid at Dexter Park play against the Bushwicks in a semi-pro game. They had teams like the Springfield Grays and the Kansas City Monarchs. This guy was better than Jackie. Why did they pick Jackie Robinson? Because he was a lot like white people. He had been in the Army, he was very well educated, and what Branch Rickey figured is, I won't let them say this guy's not intelligent. I won't let them use those stereotypes against the first black athlete, so I'm going to get somebody who takes a lot of that away from them. He was tremendously articulate, very bright, etc. So he had a lot on Josh Gibson, and he had a lot on Satchel Paige, who was bitter over not being brought up to the major leagues until he was, what, 53 years old or something? And Cleveland finally brought him up to pitch. And he was very good at 53. You can imagine what he would have been like at 23. So that's the irony there. No, I don't think America disparages or discriminates against black athletes, the Williams girls in tennis, or any of this. Arthur Ashe, or any given comparability. If they are good, I think sports takes everything away, and the sports fan will say, that guy's the best. Michael Jordan is the best. If he were green, if he were orange, or yellow, mulatto, mestizo, mezclada, or even Italian, he would be a hero. Yes?
I have a question on personal advice.
on what?
A personal advice. Now, the question more, my question is, I want to give back. I was very inspired by what you had to say, both at the Kennedy School and today. I specifically want to get into politics, but I think this question is big enough to deal with other avenues in public interest. What role do you think it is, or how important it is, for us as Harvard Law School grads to do private sector work before we get into whether elected office or in other political?
Now, this is a good question. My son is the Secretary of HUD, and my son is extremely talented, and they might even ask him to run for vice president. He's a good friend of Al Gore's, and wherever I go, you know, people tell me how good he is. And I know how good he is. He's very special. He's much more gifted than I am in many, many ways, and which is a generational thing. I mean, he's learned a lot from the mistakes I made, because I was a terrible politician. And he was there, and he saw it. He's never going to make those mistakes. And he's taken whatever few strengths I had, plus his mother's strengths, put them all together, added his own education, because he studied politics. He's terrific. He has one problem. He is not wealthy. And I have once before confessed publicly, I wish I had spent more time getting rich, which I didn't do, frankly. I was a very good lawyer. When the president invited me to the Supreme Court of the United States, it's not because I was some, you know, terrific political choice. I wasn't. I wouldn't have been popular. I was against the death penalty. He knew that. The Democrats were all for the death penalty. It would have been a big fight. The president, thought I was a good lawyer. And I was a very good lawyer. But I got involved in the pro bono cases. I did not. I supported my family, and they did all right. But I wish I had wealth, because now I go to Andrew, who has three kids and no money, and say, listen, pal, forget about money. I will take care of that. I'll help you with your family. I'm loaded. I'm like, you know, some of these other big shots. I got plenty of money. I'm going to put aside a few million. Don't worry. Go out there and give them heck. Be a politician. Now, I couldn't do that, or I would have started much younger in my own career, I think. You know, I resented the politicians and all of that. But if I had had wealth and wasn't engaged in this fight for survival, therefore, I would say it's not a bad idea to stay interested right now, to get into a law firm, at least pay off your bills. See, it's important to have independence when you go into politics, because you don't want to get yourself into a position where you need the job in order to survive. If you need the job in order to survive, then you'll do terrible things to stay there. You'll change your mind about an issue. You'll be cozy with someone you shouldn't be cozy with. So independent, the more independence you have, and let's face it, wealth will buy independence. I mean, I'm a great believer that if you wanted to run, you can stay very active, you can learn the issues, you can get in with a candidate, you can support him, and you might even go into some kind of public service if that's consistent with your making money. Then when you've got the money, then you run. So wealth is a big advantage. Number two, what you can learn in the private sector. See, people accuse me of all kinds of things. Nobody accused me of changing positions over 20 years, not on the death penalty or anything else. Why? Well, that's because you were, morally upright. No, it's a lot of hooey. It's because I had lived a whole life as a lawyer, businessman, raised a family, fought the tough questions of abortion and